So I just want to share a little bit of an opening reading for you. Even after all this time, the sun never says to the earth, "You owe me." Look what happens with a love like that. It lights the whole sky, by Hafiz. So thank you for having me here this morning, Unity North. And just like you may not have known that was my daughter, Ren, I'm Reverend Averill, for those of you I have not had the honor of meeting before. And I just wanted to say how absolutely grateful that I am to be here. And by the way, she did have her own microphone. Thank you very much. I did not steal your microphone. You left that on the table. But it's okay. I am very grateful for the invitation to serve in this way today. And I gave this talk actually at another space where I am a regular minister at Georgia Unitarian Universalist Church of the Mountains, and they do a monthly theme there. And the theme back in January was power. And when I sat with this theme, and I'm sorry, I am suffering from allergies right now, so if I'm like, it is what it is, right? So the theme was power, and I had to sit with it for a moment or two, a couple days. It just didn't feel like it was alive in me. And then, you know, it just, the universe is so amazing. I just, when I made myself open to it, it was really something that came, and I said, oh my gosh, this is very much in my own lived experience. So ultimately, the talk wasn't something I had to manufacture. It was already present, and it really was asking to be articulated. So what I'm sharing today, it doesn't come from theory alone. It comes from practice and reflection and, again, lived experience. So we're going to move forward a little bit to the next slide. And the word power to me is a polarizing word. It can sound a little aggressive. It can sound a little, no offense guys, a little masculine, maybe a little patriarchal. And when we think of power, it's often thought of as like control, maybe certainty, winning, or getting what we want. This version of that word is ego-based, and ego is not necessarily a bad thing, but it in yogic philosophy, the ego is the part of your mind that says, I. And so when we're in that mind state, we are actually a little self-centered, a little myopic, and it makes us fragile. And that kind of power is exhausting. So what I wanted to talk today was about a different kind of power, a power that's rooted in belonging rather than in control, and a power that can remain intact even when outcomes change or are suboptimal. So let's think about reframing power. I teach Qigong, if some of you may know that already. And in Qigong, which comes from traditional Chinese medicine, one of the most important symbols in that philosophy is the yin yang, which we've all seen people have like on the beach. They get it on a tattoo or on a towel or something. But it's a very poignant symbol. It represents opposite yet complementary forces of nature that are continuously interacting within living beings. And these are not abstract ideas, but expressions of life force. Yin and yang are interdependent. I want to say that word again. They're interdependent. And they never exist in isolation. Within yin, there is yang. And within yang, there is yin. And in Qigong, good health results from the balanced, harmonious flow of these energies. And the practices that I teach, they seek to cultivate and harmonize these energies. So the yin, if you look at that picture up there, it's a fish. And the yin is the black fish with the white eye in it. And it represents softness, it represents stillness, It represents inward orientation and receptivity. So in Qigong, yin appears through things like when we stand really still and maybe we imagine that we're holding a ball, or slow meditative movements, deep breathing, anything that takes the mind that likes to go like this and reverts it inward. And the yin practices, they replenish your internal resources. They relax you, they nourish your blood and your organs, and they help restore you when you're depleted. Well, the other image on there in that same chart is yang. And that's kind of when we think of power in the West and in modern times, that's what we think of. It's the white fish with the black eye. And yang is activity, it's expansion, it's outward movement, and it's expression. And in Qigong, when we do really fast moving things and we're breathing heavily, that's to replenish that yang energy. Yang practices, they activate flow and they wake up the body, and they're really good for like the morning and things like that. So, but I want you to notice that in the symbol, how it's a circle. They are in a harmonious embrace. There is a white eye in the black fish, and a black eye in the white fish. So they're in each other, they're never independent. One is always becoming the other, like the sun rises and sets all day long. So true power is a balance of those energies. True power is belonging, not just searching. It's steadiness, not just assertiveness and dominance. It's integrity, not just explosive bombasticness. Power that remains when outcomes change. It's not just dynamic. So how do we connect with this thing called power and the truest form of power? I think the avenue to being the most powerful version of yourself is softness. It's acceptance. I think the avenue to access this is really a combination of skillful action, that would be the yang, and letting go, which would be the yin. I think acceptance is often misunderstood. People think that if you accept, it means that you're wishy-washy. Jeannie and I were speaking about this before. She declared, if I may share, she goes, I'm sometimes like a control freak. And, you know, I don't think that you're alone in that. I think that most of us can get rigid, and that we feel like if we get what we want exactly the way that we want, that we have, that's power. But life doesn't work like that. And so a lot of times we're not getting what we want and then we're suffering. So acceptance is really about releasing attachment to outcome. Doesn't mean giving up responsibility. And there is not a subtle, but a profound difference. So I studied under this man named Russ Harris, and he's an Australian physician and a champion of behavioral change in a methodology called ACT. And ACT means acceptance and commitment therapy. It's the process of accepting how life is showing up, but staying resolutely committed to your values, no matter what happens outside of you. And Russ has come up with these myths that he calls the three happiness myths. And they are all mired in the absolute rigidity of attachment, the complete antithesis of acceptance. So the first happiness myth is that happiness is our default state. Like, we should wake up every day and it should look like, I don't know, like Uncle Remus or Mary Poppins, and there's like cartoon birds around. And sometimes it's just not gonna happen. Our emotions are like the weather. You know, yesterday it looked very different than it did today. And in fact, I went out to the garage, which we accidentally left up all night long. And Ren and I were like, oh my gosh, it's so cold outside. Because we just had been attached to the beautiful sunshine from the last few days. That's how we are. It's the weather's gonna change, your mood's gonna change. The second happiness myth is that happiness is not only default, but that it's permanent. Like, you should always be happy, you wake up happy, and it should be something that you get propagated all the time. But how long does any good feeling last? Like, imagine you're at a birthday party and it's really, really great and everybody shows up and they give you a present. You know, at the end of the day, they have to go home. Maybe you even have a stomach ache because you ate too much cake. It's just life. Things are gonna keep moving through. That's the theme. It's gonna move through. The last of the happiness myths is that unhappiness should be pathologized. If you're unhappy, something's wrong with you. You need to do something, you need to take a trip, you need to shop, you need medication. And that's just not true. Life is a flow, and it's gonna go up, it's gonna go down, it's gonna go yin, it's gonna go yang. And we struggle when we push against that flow. So that seems like I'm telling you again to just lay over and just whatever happens, and that's not true. So if you don't mind going to the next slide, we can still strive. Striving as a word is different to me than fighting, than resisting, than pushing. There's an intentionality to it. There's a mindfulness to it. I've mentioned already, I'm not saying we should be ambivalent and inert in our lives to the things that matter. But the greatest achievers in this world, historically and currently, are also people who've experienced the greatest failures. They just keep persevering. The fact that they endured is a testimony to non-attachment. So letting go doesn't mean disengaging. Effort matters, even when the results are different. So our actions are like waves, and they may clear space for our future selves, and they may also clear for others who really are our future selves. Integrity is not erased by disappointment. So one of the things that I love that Richard does, hi Richard, I know you'll watch this later, is that he loves to give action points. And I feel like that was one of the greatest mentoring tools, devices that he gave me. So if I'm telling you that you are already powerful, that we just have to learn how to balance out that, whatever we want to get in life, with allowing life to also show up as it wants, as it is, as it's unfolding, as your karma is in that now moment, how do we do that? How do we stay resilient enough, flexible enough, permeous enough? So I have a few strategies, and I think that they may be useful. So when you're staying anchored, first of all, you have to remember that I've said this already, but I'm going to restate it. It's not always that you're getting what you want right then. In my professional career over the last year, I've really been dealing with uncertainty. And I had management change. My work spouse divorced me and went to another position. She and I worked together for 5 years, and we used to love saying that because, you know, it's Georgia. So, and we work in clinical medicine. So we'd introduce, I'd be like, she'd be like, this is my wife, Averill, and we run this program together. It was great. It's great. You just, especially when you go to like Fayette and Noonan. So, or she's white, and we'd be like, we're twins. Just mess them all up. It was great. But Robin, I miss you. But she went to a different role, my boss left, and I was really, really in the wind and feeling really kind of put upon myself and thinking, well, you know, I'm gonna stick through this and hopefully I get this promotion out of this and then it'll be worth all the struggle. And you know what happened? I didn't get it. Not yet. They keep saying it's gonna happen. But my wonderful husband reminded me, he's like, you know, you just need to chill. You really love your job. Like, that's such a gift. Like, a lot of people just have a job where they have to get up and go to work. He goes, you actually really, really love what you do. You're good at it, and they pay you for that. You know, like, that's, like, what's the problem? And I was like, you know what? When I kind of let go of that, I must get a promotion, these other benefits started coming. And then I actually began to feel very much reinvigorated in my role that I had felt underappreciated in for a while. So yes, would I like to get this promotion? Sure. And if you're watching Piedmont, but if that doesn't happen, I'm okay right now in this space because I know that what I'm doing is good for the world. So true power is the ability to remain grounded, ethical, and open-hearted, whether or not life says yes or no. So what I'm doing in my life, I'd like to share with you. There are a few things that I'm doing that I feel like are helping to keep me resilient and in a space of being accepting. If you don't mind going to the next slide. Oh, yeah, you can. That was the one we missed, but that's okay. Let's just keep going. All right, so you can't do this if you're not taking care of yourself. You have to take care of the body and the mind. The body and the mind are the vehicle through which you're having a human experience right now. They're the vehicle for your earth journey. And all the good work that you may hope to do, whatever your goals are, whatever you want to strive for. So however big or small, powerful people are generally healthy. So it's extremely difficult to let go if your nervous system is chronically in a state of activation. We are not necessarily living in more chaotic times. I want to say that again. People love to say that. They're like, look at the times. We are not necessarily living in more chaotic times. Think about what it might have been a life to be with, you know, without electricity or running water, right? I think that those are pretty intense times. What happened is we are more aware of the chaos because we're hyper-connected. So regulation creates the conditions for discernment, for choice, and for response rather than action. So beginning the day with your gratefulness, your meditation. You know, I've taught the meditation series on Mondays in March, and there were a lot of faces that I saw regularly for that month. And, you know, every week we'd come and we'd share, this is what was up for me. This is how the week went. And time again, people were like, you know, I really want to get onto a meditation habit, Freudian. I really, really want to do this consistently. But, so, I mean, this is the enlightened folks, right? So every morning, every evening, it's time. Get consistent with this. Your healthy nervous system makes you strong and resilient, so you can be a warrior for whatever good you want to do out there. That quote that Richard uses all the time, Gandhi said, oh, my schedule's really busy today. I need to do an extra hour of meditation. We could say that every Sunday. John Kabat-Zinn, you can't stop the waves, but you can learn to surf. All right, the next one for me, they piggyback on each other. These aren't like little boxes. They're overlapping. So action point number two is that you have to do something called the stabilization practice. The human mind inclines toward negativity. It's not a bad thing. Once upon a time, you had caveman ancestors. I don't care how you think the earth was formed or not formed, whatever. There was a time that people were walking around and there were saber-toothed tigers, right? All right. So one of your ancestors did not get eaten. And they told the others, this is how I survived. And they became a little more vigilant. And they were like, hey, blah, 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 blah. Ooh, 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 I survived. Okay. So that's in our DNA. We like to, oh my gosh, this almost happened. Oh my gosh, this almost happened. So something like a gratefulness practice helps to shift the mind from that hyper-vigilant state to, oh my gosh, look at all the things that are working. So gratefulness is not gratitude. Gratefulness is not gratitude. I think we need to hear it one more time for the subconscious mind. Gratefulness is not gratitude. Gratitude is circumstantial. Thank you, I got what I wanted. Gratefulness is a steady orientation toward the value of life itself. Gratefulness is a steady orientation toward the value of life itself, which means that even in an awful moment, there is an opportunity, to quote David Steindl-Rast, there's an opportunity for gratefulness. It completely inclines the heart toward acceptance. It looks for whatever is available to drop down on the knees and be grateful for. Gratefulness, it perpetuates tenacity and positivity. And even in the most difficult moment, maybe we can pause. And I can be a catastrophizer. I don't know about you guys. But maybe we can be grateful for our breath. Maybe we can be grateful for a comfortable seat to sit and just pause and reflect. Then we start to think, okay, I'm grateful because I have people to help me, or I'm grateful that I have health or love or whatever resource. I'm grateful I can turn the light switch on. As we learn to give thanks for all of life and death, even for suffering, we find a deep joy. It is the joy of trust, the joy of faith in the faithfulness at the heart of all things. So far I've said, you know, to dig into the power, we have to have a few different things. We have to have a healthy nervous system. That healthy nervous system helps us to align with an attitude of gratefulness, the value of gratefulness. The next thing is that we might want to work on being a little vulnerable, especially if we're self-professed control freaks. Vulnerability is a power that can relate. That ego-based power that I mentioned before, it relies on armor and it relies on certainty and image. Armor, certainty, and image. True power allows being affected, not knowing, and staying open. I don't know, and that's okay. Vulnerability is not the same as oversharing. It means I'm willing to be hurt, not necessarily physically. I'm willing to stretch. When you stretch, do you feel a little bit of discomfort, right? And I'm willing to put myself out there for whatever it is I want to do to better myself and the world. Vulnerability is integrity without armor. By choosing integrity, we become more whole, but also more vulnerable. Yet vulnerability is not weakness. It's the courage to be present. Parker Palmer. We're almost there. So action point number 4, and everybody here should have known this is what I would have said. You have to be quiet. You have to go into the silence. And I'm not just talking about when we die on the couch at the end of the day in the Netflix binge, which, you know, I do it too. Like, it's okay. It is what it is. But that's not your resilience training. There's got to be a time where you're allowing the mind to go in and explore what's underneath that ebb and flow of thoughts, just like we did right before this practice, this talk together. It's cultivating a relationship with my favorite yogic word, and it makes people laugh all the time, the buddhi, not B-O-O-T-Y. It's B-U-D-D-H-I, buddhi. Sounds a little bit like Buddha. The etymological root of this word is bud, like to bloom, B-U-D. And it's that part of the mind that helps us to connect with the best course of action. You know, we can call it the conscience. I think it's a little more nuanced than that. I think it's the voice of the Christ consciousness. And it's what's asking what's really, truly needed in any moment. It's saying step forward or pull back. And if we're doing these silencing practices, that voice becomes more clear and more rooted. We're able to steer our ship from that point, which is beautiful and spontaneous and organic. So meditation is an opportunity to realign with the center of consciousness, which is the source of wisdom and power. This is a reinforcement of action point 1, which was nervous system regulation. That doesn't have to be meditation. That could be, you know, a walk in nature. But there has to be some time when we are sitting still. So the last of the action points is from that voice, that still small voice, which I hope over time becomes louder and more in your face as opposed to still and small and buried, you begin to choose wise effort. Again, acceptance is not passivity. After steeping in the silence, we've removed whatever barriers to listening to that heart mind for a course of action. And we can act fully without clinging to outcome. You know, one of the reasons we don't always get what we want is that yogic Eastern philosophy of karma. Karma is not a bad thing. It's not a good thing either. Like when you get a good parking spot, it's not like you suddenly have magically good karma, and if you stub your toe, you have bad karma. It's much more, we use that word very, kind of pejoratively. But it's just the action and reaction of the universe, not just individually, but societally. So sometimes we're striving for something and it doesn't work out, but it may be that there's numerous barriers. As we keep with tenacity going, pursuing, breathing, pausing, replenishing, little by little, we actually clear that space. It's not always going to be one and done. So trying to resist the changes that come your way, instead of that, let life live through you. So all of this is, it's really not an exact science, if you don't mind going forward. It's an invitation. You know, I love the word practices, because that means you have to do them over and over and over again. There's not going to be a time when I'm like, oh, I've mastered meditation. I'm always going to be a student. I'm always going to be a practitioner. I'm always going to have periods where I'm really practiced up and periods where I'm like, oh, I got to put some fire under it. I know from lived experience that when I'm consistent with taking care of my nervous system, letting go of my heavy attachments, allowing life to flow through me more, I experience more of what Russ Harris called happiness. And maybe it's not this elated, ecstatic thing, but it's just feeling good. I mean, isn't that enough, right? I like that feeling. So experiment and notice how some of these tactics shape your presence and choices. I also invite you to speak to yourself lovingly when you do fall short. Self-compassion is not an indulgence. It is the ground that allows wise effort to continue. So I found this really beautiful poem, and it might be a little small, and I'll read it, but if you want to take a picture of it, it's really lovely because it's exactly about this. It's called We Look with Uncertainty by Anne Hillman. We look with uncertainty beyond the old choices for clear-cut answers to softer, more permeable aliveness, which is every moment at the brink of death. For something new is being born in us if we but let it. We stand at a new doorway, awaiting that which comes, daring to be human creatures, vulnerable to the beauty of existence, learning to love. Thank you so much for letting me hang out with you here today.